Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast is supported in part by the Bertha Foundation.
Hello, hello.
We've got two great interviews for you today. Giordano from The Juice Media and also Rod Quantock. But before we do that, I just want to acknowledge I'm on Gadigal land in the Eora Nation.
And I'm on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation.
All right, let's kick it off with the climate news.
Despite global warming, a rational fear is adding a little more hot air with long-form discussions with climate leaders, good and bad.
This is Carl. Don't be afraid.
The
heat waves and drought.
Greatest.
Mass extinction.
Moral.
We're facing a man-made disaster.
Podcast.
They're the climate criminals.
Of our generation.
All of this with the global warming and that, and a lot of it's a hoax.
The greatest moral podcast of our generation.
Goompog. For short.
Now, Lynn, before we get straight into the climate news, I want to let everybody know that we are doing live shows in Newcastle and Vega for A Rational Fear. We're also going to Melbourne, but a little bit later on. We are performing June 5 in Newcastle, where we'll have James Pender from Sammy J, Kirsten Drysdale from Reputation Rehab and Hungry Beast, Lewis Hobber, also from Triple J. It's basically people who used to be on Hungry Beast. It's going to be a Hungry Beast mini reunion. It's going to be fantastic. And also James Pender from the Ronnie John's Half Hour, an old TV show that I used to do on Channel 10. Also, we've got Georgina Woods, who is from Lock the Gate, and DJ Dilabolical from News Fighters. It's going to be fast, funny. It's going to be like Q&A on crack. We're going to be talking a lot about the Upper Hunter. So if you are in Newcastle and you want to come along, please do. It's going to be great. Tickets have already started to sell. I think we've sold 20 or 30 tickets already.
And amazing.
Yeah, and we're trying to work out also a workshop that you can be at, Lynn, where we do some kind of digital meme workshop where we can teach people how to make memes on the internet.
It's going to be a hoot. It's going to be this funny thing where we're meeting offline, in real life, in person to do things on the internet. I think this is how all great digital activism starts, is actually not on the internet. So get excited and get tickets.
So, do follow Irrational Fear on all the social medias and we'll let you know when that workshop's going to be. But June 5 at the Newcastle Civic Theatre, get your tickets. Details are in the show notes. All right, huge week in climate news this week. We could talk a bit about Bravis losing their water license to create the Galilee coal mine, which is pretty funny. You know, it's good comedy to see these guys going ahead, creating a coal mine. But we won't, because something has wiped that off the slate. And we are very lucky to be joined by Antonio Juhas, fellow Bertha fellow, to talk to us through some of the biggest news happening in climate probably ever.
Antonio, thanks for joining us. We just woke up to this excellent news, but tell us more. Has this been a good, bad, what sort of wake has the fossil fuel industry been having?
No, I'd say it's been a really, really knock their heads together, run over them with a tractor, drag them behind the the wheel of the car kind of weak.
Drag them behind the wheel of an electric car, probably a new F-150 Lightning, maybe.
No, I think they're going to, I think it's like drag them behind a car that's puffing out a whole lot of polluting exhaust that make them suck it in for making the rest of us do it and hold them accountable for it, kind of weak.
All right. And now we've had a couple of huge rulings by shareholders and by court. Let's walk us through just quickly. What? First of all, let's start off with Shell in the Netherlands. Shell is being forced to slash its pollution by a Dutch court.
It's a massive ruling. So the court upheld that companies have a requirement under the Paris Climate Accord to essentially meet the standards of the Paris Climate Accord, and that it runs contrary to the guaranteed human rights guaranteed to European citizens for Shell to destroy the climate. And so Shell must change its practices so that it doesn't destroy the climate. And the ruling ordered the company to nearly halve, so by 40%, cut its emissions across its entire supply chain, its entire chain, production chain, within less than 10 years. So by 2030, a 45% cut in emissions from counting not only its own production and exploration and refining and transporting of oil and natural gas, but also what its suppliers contribute to emissions and what its consumers contribute to emissions.
Wow. So we're talking scope one, scope two, scope three, the whole thing.
Indeed.
Wow, that's such a cool thing. Like, it's so incredible that this fossil fuel giant is kind of being pulled together like this by a regulatory body. And I guess the Netherlands is so progressive in places, like, in kind of areas like this. Or, like, how do they get to this point of kind of forcing Shell to do this?
They're saying that in signing the Paris Climate Accord, nations have created, essentially, have agreed on a moral norm. And that moral norm is that the world cannot be warmed beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that not only are governments accountable to that norm, but with this ruling, so too are companies. So that there isn't an international body that exists to regulate multinational corporations. And that's what the court is also saying, is it is the obligation of the company to adhere to the norms of its home government and the agreements that that government has signed, including the Paris Climate Accord and including human rights accords under the European Union for the case of Shell and the Netherlands.
This sounds like it's going to be a great day for Australian corporates. I can see Shell moving their headquarters to Canberra, where Australia will provide sanctuary for companies like Shell to keep polluting at current levels.
I mean, I wonder if that would solve the problem. Certainly what would not solve Shell's problem is to move its operations from one place to another. So, for example, the court's really clear that wherever the cuts come from, Shell has to achieve a 45% reduction. So if Shell moved all of its operations to Australia, it would still have to meet this obligation. I have no idea what would happen if it moved its headquarters.
Also, let's talk about Exxon and Chevron quickly. As someone who's covered this space, how are you feeling about shareholders kind of holding these two companies to account this week?
All three events happened with Exxon's annual shareholder meeting, Chevron's annual shareholder meeting, Shell's court ruling, all happened on Wednesday, May 26, 2021. It's a day that's going to go down in infamy for these oil companies. Shareholders at Exxon got two seats on the board for activist shareholders that want to force the company to act to be more aggressive on climate and to address the climate, to do anything on the climate. And over at Chevron, shareholders forced the company to have much more aggressive accounting on how its emissions impact the climate and to try and reduce those emissions.
For you, as someone who's covered this energy space forever, how do you feel about a day like this and what does it mean to you?
It's a day of reckoning for the oil industry. It's saying you're going to have to shrink your footprint, that the climate crisis is real. It's been accepted. there are costs associated that people across the spectrum are not going to take, so are not going to accept any longer. And that's those impacted by the harms, that's investors, that's policymakers, that's financiers, so that it's a statement from everyone who suffers the consequences of these, of the companies continuing to operate without any concern for their impact on the climate or unwillingness to respond to their own knowledge about their harms on the climate, that will not be accepted anymore, that the costs are too high, however one measures the word cost.
Yeah, and environmentally, socially, definitely, financially. It's so fascinating to see how the world is moving to this direction, but there are a few rogue states like Australia who are still accounting for emissions in a way that is only financial and can't measure this for long-term strategy, for long-term value creation. And it's so disheartening being in this country to see the leadership of our country not even considering this, not even blinking, putting in more gas when the rest of the world is getting out rapidly.
But that's the thing. It's like, talk about rogue actors. There's no more rogue actor than Exxon. There's almost no more rogue actor than Chevron. There's almost no more rogue actor than Shell. And what each of these events is an attempt to say, well, you may want to be rogue, but we're going to hold you to account. So for example, this is basically trying to get at it from every angle. So if the regulate you, then the court will hold the company to account. If the courts and the governments will hold the company to account, then the shareholders will. If the shareholders won't, then the lenders will. If the lenders won't, then, you know, like, and that's what's happening, is that basically, you know, this has been building over decades of organizing and activism and demands to try and get at this problem at every single way, because you're talking about the world's most powerful and wealthy, or they used to be, companies. And the world's most powerful and wealthy countries, which are many of which, if they continue to tie themselves to fossil fuels, they won't be either. So the companies are no longer the most powerful companies. When I wrote my book, The Tyranny of Oil, the world's most powerful industry and what we must do to stop it in 2008, it was the world's most powerful industry. It's not today.
Yeah.
It's not the case anymore. And that is going to happen to the governments too.
So I guess, Antonio, the other thing that for me kept coming up with all of this really great news overnight is like scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. Do you mind just like telling us what are scope 3 emissions for listeners that might not be aware?
Oh, I hope I can. So let's see. Scope 3 emissions are the emissions that are burned by the consumers of fossil fuels. So those are the emissions that come when we drive our cars and airplanes fly. And companies have tried to say that that's not their responsibility. They've used the argument that tobacco companies use, which was, well, we know that our product is harmful and we know that it hurts people, but if you want to drive it and you want to fly it, then that's your fault.
It's an argument that the NRA has used a lot as well, right? It's not guns that kill people, it's the people that use the guns. And I think fossil fuel companies have definitely gotten away with that too. People just buy the coal. I mean, how are we meant to dictate how they use it? It's not our responsibility. Handball.
Exactly. And similarly, misled the public about what they knew to be the consequences of that consumption, right? So the companies knew the consequences of that consumption decades ago, and that's part of the Shell case that the plaintiffs are arguing, is that Shell has known for decades the harms of this of consumption of its product, and helped mislead the public about that, and did not act accordingly on that information. And so it also is part of, similar to the tobacco argument, is that consumers actually didn't know it, they were misled about what the harms would be of that consumption. And now the companies with the Shell ruling are being told, actually, you have to account for that, for that consumption. And also that's what Chevron is saying, what its shareholders are saying to the company is, we're going to require you to account for that consumption as well.
Thank you, Antonio Juhas, fellow Bertha fellow.
Thank you, Lynn and Dan.
Look at us hanging out.
You. Look, I think that's enough climate news, but I want to leave you with one other thing, Lynn. You know, our Minister for Emissions Reduction, Angus Taylor.
My favourite.
He was asked on 3AW by Neil Mitchell if he drives an electric car. What do you think his answer was?
Oh, I mean, even though you'd think it'd be in his job description, he probably walked around the answer and told us all something a little bit depressing. It's not that he's riding his bike everywhere, but he's driving a Guzzler.
Now, he made it absolutely clear, and he said, I am not driving an electric car, like, as if he's never going to drive an electric car.
He's just waiting for self-driving cars. That maybe that's what he meant, you know, if we give him, like, the smallest modicum of doubt.
Yeah, he says, I live in regional New South Wales and drive huge distances every year, 60 or 70,000 kilometres, so I need something that can handle hard roads and distances. He drives a Ford Everest, which is a five-cylinder car, which pumps out 225 grams of CO2 equivalent per kilometre. That's a can of Coke of CO2 every kilometre. Angus is putting 70,000 cans of Coke worth of CO2 in the air every year. Is this what the Minister for Emissions Reduction should be doing?
Do you reckon he's offsetting?
No, he's not offsetting. He's just put in a gas plant for $600 million where there's no money to be found. Also, he did this on the same day. He kind of came out on 3AW the same day that Joe Biden was riding around in a brand new Ford F-150 Lightning, Ford's brand new electric Ute, the biggest truck in America, the most popular car in America. Joe Biden launched it with Ford last week. And just the optics at the same time, Angus going, no, I'm not going to, there's no way I'm going to drive an electric car. No, fuck that. And then Joe Biden going, here is the most masculine electric car you could possibly get. Ta-da.
Here I am driving it. And I don't know for any of our listeners who have been to the US, obviously pre-pandemic times, but their cars are way bigger than any of our cars are. You know, like these are huge monsters. So if we can make one of those vehicles electric, pretty sure Angus Taylor might be eating his words very soon for breakfast.
That's it for the climate news. We've got two super great interviews for you today. First of all, we've got Giordano from The Juice Media. If you don't know The Juice Media, here is some of their work.
Hello, I'm from the government with an important message as we enter the third decade of the 21st century. Things are going, fine. Overall, the Amazon is fine. Half of Africa is fine. So is the Arctic. Indonesia, Spain, Greece. Even Greenland's on fucking fire. I mean, fine. Scientists have coined a new term for this stage of climate change we're entering. We're fucked. Unlike the previous stage, which climate scientists called Listen to Us or We Might Be Fucked, We're Fucked is happening, and in your lifetime. This is thanks to us wasting decades piss-farting around at climate summits with non-binding emission targets, whilst handing out subsidies to climate criminals, obstructing renewables, and generally not giving a shit that rising CO2 levels are about to trigger what scientists call feedback loops. A feedback loop is the scientific term for when a species uses its own ignorance to screw itself and everything else around it so hard that its own planet tells it to git fo. Some people are already experiencing we're fucked, such as these Pacific nations facing rising sea levels, who recently begged Australia to please stop burning coal, to which Australia responded, get fucked.
Really funny stuff.
Always makes me laugh.
Juice Media stuff has so much cut through, would you say, Lynn?
Yes, and every time I see it on, you know, like scrolling through social media, I always think it's sort of real until I was like, no. There's some genius behind this. It is satire because it's just so on point with whatever's topical at that moment in time.
Giordano and Juice Media have long been championing climate conversations through the comedy that they make on their channel. Another person who has been championing climate conversations is a legend called Rod Quantock, Australian comedian, been around forever. I did a panel with him in 2008 and I remember him saying something, well, I'm throwing out all of my material and just focusing on climate because there's nothing else to talk about. And I thought, oh my God, that's incredible. That's so interesting. And that's probably why I started Irrational Fear. So I should let you know that Rod's conversation is a little more depressing. So
just very sober about the reality and the facts. And, you know, I guess it comes with working on something for well over a decade, but when he wants to crack a joke, still funny, but yeah, this work is not easy and I think we need to just give people at times the space to feel all their emotions.
Exactly. So you can feel despair, which is an emotion, with Rod Quantock.
You're listening to the greatest moral podcast of our generation.
Giordano, welcome to the greatest moral podcast of our generation.
Awesome to be here. Thanks, Dan.
Does that feel too weighty, a weighty title on your shoulders to be part of the greatest moral podcast of our generation?
It definitely, yes, but I'll do my best to live up to it.
Been an absolute fan of your work for, a decade, ever since the early Juice Wrap News days. It's so thrilling to kind of see you grow and blow up and ultimately become self-sustaining. And I don't know how you feel about this word. Very successful. But it's a thrill to kind of sit down with you and talk through your work and talk through your process for what is essentially enlightening the world in a funny way.
Oh, I appreciate that. That's very kind. Thanks.
First of all, you are a historian. How does your background as a historian inform your comedy, do you think?
I mean, you know, whenever people ask me these kind of questions, I don't know how sort of deep to go. And sometimes I ask myself these questions as well. I think, you know, the simplest way of answering is that studying history really kind of like makes you think, what are some of the big picture frameworks that you have to apply? Because whenever you talk about history, it's really important to sort of put things in context, you know, of the year that you're in, the decade you're in, the century, and then ultimately humanity and this whole journey that we're on, you know? And so that's studying history has really helped me to kind of like juggle all of those perspectives to think about the really big timescales and also the very small timescales, because that's where it really gets exciting when you can bring those two things together.
Yeah.
And then you go click, oh my God, this is where we're at. Oh my God. And, you know, and a lot comes from that feeling of, oh wow, we're living in a really historic time, you know. And when people say that, we've got a saying that I often invoke, history is happening, meaning, you know, history isn't something that's just in the past. It's something we're living through right now. It's just that we don't see it. We just think, oh, history is something in the past and right now is the present. But, you know, in a decade from now, people will look back and see this as history. And so, well, what are we going to do about that? What kind of history do we want to leave for people in the future? So I often don't think of myself as a historian that looks at the past, but a historian that looks at ourselves from the future.
Well, that's exactly kind of what I was thinking about when I was thinking about your work. Your work is so detailed and it's filled with minutiae. And I wonder what will historians think about the work you've created, you know, 30 years time. Do you ever think about that? Do you feel like you're almost laying breadcrumbs for future historians to kind of understand this time better?
I've never thought of it that way. But, you know, I think future historians will have so many fucking breadcrumbs to, you know, I really pity future historians because, you know, with the arrival of the internet and social media, I mean, like, how do you even keep track of, you know, the archives of the future will be shit shows.
Can you imagine a future historian coming across QAnon and trying to understand what QAnon is?
Yeah. No, and then trying to go through 8chan forums and, you know, and it's,
Tell me, Giordano, what is shitfuckery?
Shitfuckery is a word that kind of, I don't know, materialized itself. I don't even remember when. Because I think I was just trying to search for a word that kind of tried to even get close to the level of corruption, ineptitude, arrogance, fucking betrayal of basic, you know, morality and human rights that this government upholds on a daily basis here in Australia. And that word just came to me, you know, as in, you know, sort of a vision. It was like, yeah, that kind of gets pretty close to it. And I don't think when I first used it in one of our Honest Government ads, I thought it was anything special, but people really kind of latched onto it and went, wow, yes, that's what it is, you know? And so I was like, okay, I'll keep using it. And now it's become like a something of a sort of something that people associate with us quite a bit with the Honest Government ads.
But not only you, I have seen it now sprinkled through the zeitgeist a little bit. Have you seen it leak out outside of the Jewish media world?
Yeah, occasionally I see it pop up. Someone had a sign at the March for Justice in Canberra. They added cunty shitfuckery in front of it, which I thought was a very nice addition. Kudos to them. But yeah, every now and then I see it pop up. Yeah. And yeah, some people wear the t-shirt, they go through customs or arrive in Australia wearing the Department of Shitfuckery t-shirt, which I think, and then they post it on Twitter, which I think is quite brave. And, you know, so every now and then I see it coming up, which is nice. Yeah.
Now, I find this time we're in is really interesting because we're at a pretty crucial time in history and human history in that. I think there's enormous humour about how we are not dealing with climate change, but it's incredibly sad at the same time. With your historian hat on, how do you think future generations will feel about the kind of delay we are having right now on climate action?
Yeah, I think it's going to be brutal. Yeah, I think it's really, it's going to be horrible. The weight of history is going to put on our generation collectively. And, you know, I know that you know, some people say, yes, we're doing something and we're saying and we're speaking up and everything, but collectively, you know, the Gretas of the future are going to be, they're all going to be Gretas in the future. They're all going to be fucking pissed off with us, and rightly so. I mean, that is one of the reasons that I think, you know, we talk about climate so much is that feeling of nausea really that comes with, oh my God, is this really fucking happening? Are we really doing this? Like, this can't be happening. And I already feel angry, and so many people feel angry today. So I can only imagine how that will be amplified in the future if we don't at this point now take a different path. Because, okay, you could say that 10 years ago there was still, you know, uncertainty, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. And you can, we gave the deniers so many opportunities to really sort of prove the point that, you know, there wasn't a need to act urgently. And now that's no, we've done it. We've wasted those decades. Okay, but now we really have to fucking do it. And we're still not, because mainly because of the government that we have. I mean, so many sectors of Australian society, the market, industry, business people, entrepreneurs are just moving ahead. They're saying, fuck it, let's just do it. And the rest of the world is doing it as well. Like, we're literally becoming the laggards. It's getting to the point where it's not even funny anymore. It's actually pathetic.
It's pathetic and it's demoralizing. Mm. And, you know, to hear these government delay tactics at the federal level so blatantly coming out and saying stuff like, you know, we acknowledge it's real, and we know we've got to do something about it, but we're going to do it with technology. Oh, and the technology's not there yet, but it will be soon. So just give us another few decades of using fossil fuels.
Yeah. I mean, there's that element of it that is just on its own is already fucking irritating.
Yeah.
But then there's the other flip side of it is that there are so many opportunities that we could be embracing right now, which could absolutely secure the future of Australian manufacturing, jobs, which in turn then spills into society, you know, education, healthcare, all of these sort of things, which could be powered by Australia becoming a renewable energy superpower. Everything is laid out in front of us. I've just been reading Ross Garnaut's book, Superpower, which I really recommend, actually. I'd want to talk about it a bit more in some of the podcasts coming up. And it's just heartbreaking, the opportunities that we're not taking, which could be benefiting Australia so much, especially rural and country Australia, which ironically is where so many of the Liberal Party, Liberal National Party, seems to win a lot of seats. So it blows your mind. Anyway.
Can you remember the first time you took notice of climate change or the lack of climate action as an issue that you were really passionate about, you wanted to communicate through Juice?
Well, it was before Juice. I think we started the Juice Media Channel in 2008. I think for me, it was when I was an undergrad uni student at UWA and I heard David Suzuki came and talk. He spoke at Winthrop Hall and he gave this amazing talk, which was quite a catalyst and a turning point. And then I had a lecturer at uni who introduced me to, sort of on the sly, gave me books and said, oh, have you read? He was actually South African and he said, you've got some really great writers here, but you know, they're not very celebrated here. So he gave me a book by John Pilger. He gave me a book and then a couple of others. He gave me The Gaia Theory by James Lovelock. He was a bit of a revolutionary kind of lecturer that kind of tried to radicalize. He did, you know, he really.
And look at you.
Exactly. Yeah, it's all his fault. And those are kind of some of the texts that, you know, I read when I was quite young, probably 16, 17, and that kind of really imprinted on me that issue being of urgency. I don't know. I've just, yeah, it's just been a constant theme, really. And then when we started Juice in 2008 and Rap News in 2009, I think one of the first episodes we had was about climate. So it was really pretty much the thing that we always spoke about from the very beginning, I think.
For you, like out of all the things you've done on climate, do you have one that stands out as the thing that you're like, this is the marquee climate statement that we've done so far?
Yeah, we did a video about the fires towards the end of the deadly tragic bushfires that we had here in Australia. And I feel like that really kind of tapped into where we are at now with climate, with our government's policy, which is kind of this really interesting and sort of also, you know, terrifying approach to climate, which has been for years denying and delaying and obfuscating. And then all of a sudden with the bushfires, realizing that that's not going to cut it anymore. And then skipping the part where we say, okay, let's do something about it.
Totally.
And skipping that and going straight to, oh, well, we're going to have to adapt and build resilience. And this is just a reality and we have to accept. And it's like, what the fuck? What happened to the step in between that, you motherfuckers, you know? Sorry, I get really upset about this shit.
No, well, this is the podcast to get upset about, please. You know.
And And I feel like that video really kind of captured that moment quite accurately, and it had a great response from a lot of people. A lot of climate scientists and climate communicators also took notice, and we had a lot of sort of response from them. And one of them was Michael Mann, a climate scientist from the US who was visiting at the time for a sabbatical. And he when he came down to Melbourne, we met up and we hung out, and we really kind of connected, and we spoke a lot about climate shit fuckery, and you know, and he was really keen to help out with. He's kind of become like a de facto advisor, and he's come back on the podcast a couple of times. So that was a real kind of catalyst. But we've done so many. There are others as well, but that was kind of the one that I feel like I'm most proud of, let's say. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say he's become kind of a de facto father figure. Yeah, I think Rational Fear, we did a similar thing. Like we made a 12-minute explainer about the constant delay tactics and how the fossil fuels engaged in politics in Australia and is basically responsible for getting rid of every single leader who ever wanted to do anything on climate action. And that was, I remember sitting on the beach at Bondi, sitting with ash falling on me and just texting people saying, we need to make a video. We need to get this going. You know, texting them.
You made a great video about this. I remember, I can't remember the name, but it had a really good.
Yeah, Tim Minchin.
That's right.
Tim Minchin voiced it.
Narrated it, yeah.
It was, Kara Schlegel wrote it, and we just put it together.
That was really good. Are you going to do more collaborations of that sort?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, we'd love to.
Sorry, I'm going to take over the interview.
Of course,
now.
You know, but things like that cost money to make. Yeah, you know, yeah. Do you know anything about making online content, Jordana? Shit costs money. But yeah, so the podcast is kind of the focus of the boat because it's cheap. So economic wise, if I've got an audience with the podcast, then I can start paying people to do the videos.
Give Dan more money, people, because that was really good and needs to make more of it. If you're listening, where should they go to support you?
They know they're listening to this podcast. Now, do you have a theory about comedy and change? Do you have an encompassing theory about, you know, if you can make people laugh, you might actually be able to change things?
I don't know. I just do it because it feels, I don't know, it comes naturally as this way of kind of expressing anger and frustration, and comedy is a way of doing it that sort of doesn't leave us in a sort of a puddle of inaction and sort of depressive, just inaction, paralysis. You know, I feel like laughter takes away fear and it emboldens people and it makes us feel like, oh, laughter is also kind of like, it's a really unifying element. Like when we laugh, it's like, oh, we both get that thing, you know? And so it kind of creates a sense of a shared sense of identity of like, yes, this is shit, but we all know that we're in the situation, and that can't not be positive for change, because once you have that kind of group identity, once people understand what shitfuckery is and they bond around concepts or ideas or understandings, you would expect that to lead to change. But I mean, yeah, I've never theorized it as such, but I would say, yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
Do you ever find yourself galvanizing your audience around a particular issue and getting them to do things? Like, do you ever because you've got such a powerful audience and you've got such a clued in audience, smart audience, and you know, it's huge, your footprint online. Do you ever figure out, you know, do you ever drive them to actions?
We have occasionally, yeah. I mean, you know, we it depends on the topic, really. We did a video, for example, about the anti-encryption legislation that ended up being voted through by both houses of parliament. Surprise, surprise.
They're listening to this podcast right now.
Yeah, great. Good job. There was a Senate inquiry submission process where you could submit comments. And so we, you know, naively thought, hey, let's get people to submit comments to this Senate inquiry, and then maybe they'll take notice of what people are saying. And I think we drove something like 17 or 18,000 submissions to that. You know, I mean, it's one example. And you know, all of those submissions are completely fucking ignored, you know. So
what you're saying is democracy works.
Yeah. You know, we try and we push, you know, if there is anything that people can do, or, you know, that we feel like there's something practical, we sort of encourage that, you know. But I'm never under any illusion that you can change things with a petition or a Senate submission. They're all good things and we need to do them, but there's no illusion that that's what, you know, at the end of the day, we've got to vote this shitty government out. And elect a better one. So I feel like that's really where it counts is in the electoral. And at that point, you know, and all along the way, there are decisions that we can make, you know, to lead to that outcome. But that's the real aim of the videos that we make.
For you, all your videos are incredibly well thought out and very values driven. Do you ever have political parties tap you on the shoulder and go, hey, Giordano, want to do something about this issue that we would love you to do this, to help us with this thing?
Not really. A lot of people think that that's what happens. A lot of people sort of say, yeah, I've had a lot of people saying, oh, you must be paid for by the Greens or sometimes by the Labour Party. For some reason, never by the Liberal Party.
The Greens can't afford your production values.
But no, I mean, no. I think everyone kind of – I feel like the parties that that would want us to do stuff feel like, you know, that we already produce content that sort of supports their policies and there's no need to waste their money on it.
Yeah, so Clive Palmer, if you're listening, could you please drop Giordano a couple of $1 million to do some pro Galilee Basin content?
That's right, yeah.
Have you ever heard from people – in the corridors of power about how your work may inform the decisions that they're making?
No, I know, not at all. I'd love to. I'd love to be a fly on the wall when some MP or senator is watching one of our videos. But no, I haven't actually, no.
I mean, that's the dream, right? The dream is to have someone go, ah, oh, fuck, Juice has done a video on this.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure Susan Lee, Environment Minister, said that when we did a video about the Jabberong trees and we kind of focused on her. On her role, I'm very surprised if she hasn't seen that. So I'm just going to have to imagine it. Somebody did an FOI request for the Juice Media. They said, can you send us all this? Because there was a whole discussion. I don't know if you remember a little while ago, the government sort of started sending us emails about the use of the government logo. Well, they called it a logo. I always thought it was called a coat of arms. They're like corporate motherfuckers. It's our logo. And I'm like, what? Okay, anyway, so they call it a logo and they wrote us a letter saying, just come to our attention that, you know, you're using our logo in your videos and we're concerned that these could be mistaken for real government communications, at which I nearly spurted out my coffee because I thought it was hilarious. That's all it takes to confuse real government policies with satire is just the logo. Is that all it is? Is that how close we are to sort of the reality here? What does it say about the policies? So there must have been a lot of communication going around that issue before. So somebody lodged an FOI and it was quite interesting seeing the conversations. That's the closest I've got. And somebody said in response to the video, which caused this email to be sent out to us, they said something like, oh, this must be the latest wave on social media. And it was someone in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. I can't remember who. Some staffer. And so we put that up on our banner. It was like the next wave on social media. I suspect this is the next wave on social media. Yeah, pretty much. Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, Australian Government.
I mean, if you were doing a comedy festival show, that is a great slogan to put on your poster, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I put it up there. It's still there on our Twitter banner. It's, But if you don't know the backstory, you might not know what that is. So that explains why that's up there.
Now, can you give me a bit of a rundown of your work process, like from ideation to creation to publishing, like what does that look like, you know, in terms of your ways of working? How do you put what appears to be an enormous amount of content out every year?
Cocaine is usually the first thing. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, like, I mean, you know, we don't put out as much content as a lot of other creators, probably not nearly as much as you put out or others, you know, in the scene. So I've kind of, the process that I've gone for is like, I mean, like you guys and The Chaser and The Shovel and Friendly Geordies, you know, whatever, there's a lot of very prolific commentators on politics. I've kind of gone, you know, we've got a young family and I'm past the point where I can sort of just smash it out every week or every second week. So we've kind of gone for like, okay, cool. There's a lot of people commentating on stuff on the fly, like as it comes out. And I kind of see that even though we don't know each other personally, it's the first time we've met. I've met James from The Shovel once, you know, we have a little bit of like a camaraderie. We're part of a team that's kind of like working individually. Sometimes, you know, we cross paths, but generally we're kind of like working on a similar goal. And I've kind of thought, well, everyone's taking care of the here and now. And like, you know, stuff comes out, people are onto it, you know, straight away. I'm going to focus a little bit more on sort of broader picture, pick up some issues that get lost along the way or that maybe aren't as time, you know, sensitive. So we put out a video every month, sometimes two, but usually one, and a podcast, you know. So that's the time frame, the longer time frames. The work process is I spend most of that time just reading and researching and talking to people, you know, really experts in the fields that we want to discuss. just thinking about, you know, how to approach this topic in a way that's really going to cut through. Once the video is written, that's the hardest part. And then that's when the fun part starts. You know, we record it. Lucy is my partner, does the voice for the video. So we get into the booth. That's always fun because we've got to try and do it between the Juno's naps and Lucas play dates and stuff. So that's a dance, another dance. And then we get our actors in, Zoe and Ellen, and that's always a fun time filming. And then I edit it in a couple of days, maybe 3-4 days, sometimes with the help of a couple of VFX, Brent, who helps out with VFX, and then we put it out. So that's the process, really.
So the production doesn't take up your living room for too long a time. Like, you've kind of worked it out so it doesn't, you know, take up your life.
That's right, yeah. It takes up about a day or two of the month or, you know, longer if we do a couple of videos. And then the rest of the time, this room where we were chatting in, it becomes like a playground, a rumpus room, you know?
Now, what do you think is the power of subverting a government ad? What do you think is the secret sauce there? Why are people attracted to that?
I don't know. It's irreverent. It usurps the voice of this government. And I feel like, you know, if this government has just done so much to erode public trust and confidence, and it's just always mincing words and beating around the bush and not really coming and being honest with people about what it's doing. You know, the rhetoric and the bullshit really is just a constant charade, really, trying to conceal the reality of the policy. So I feel like it's the reason it appeals to people to impersonate this particular government, probably all shit governments, is that it's just cathartic. It's like, oh, fuck. Imagine if that's how this government spoke. Yes, they're pieces of shit, but at least they're honest about being pieces of shit. I feel like that would remove the most annoying part of the government, this government that we had. At least then they're honest, you know. There's something cathartic and kind of therapeutic about that, I think.
What I'm hearing from you is a smart staffer would tap ScoMo on the shoulder and said, actually, we should put out an honest ad. That way Juice Media won't have anything to complain about.
We'll put them out of business. Yeah, totally. Actually, yeah, well, I'm scripting a video about the electric vehicle policy at the moment, and I've got a line in there. I'm not sure if I'll use it, but it's something along the lines of, you know, introducing our future fuel strategy. The acronym is FFS. And then the next line is like, no, that's not a joke. That's part of our strategy to put satirists out of business. Fuck you, the chaser and the shovel and honest government ad shitheads, you know. I love the fact that even their acronyms are satirical now. It's like FFS, you know. But yeah, they probably should definitely not do that. It's very effective, you know. I hate this government and its policies, but they what they do is actually very effective. They're very consistent with their obfuscation.
Now, honest government ads is a format you've been doing for some years now. Can you remember the first one you did and you went, uh-huh, this is a great format.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to rinse and repeat this.
Yeah. We used to do a series called Rap News and we finished that in 2015. And after that, I had this decision to, you know, like, well, what do I do? Do I go back to university or do I try and keep doing this YouTube thing? You know, we had no Patreon support at the time. So it was like, you know, do I want a job or do I want to be unemployed? That was the basic decision. And I chose the latter and I'm really glad I did that. But the immediate challenge that I had was like, well, what am I going to do now? We've done Rap News. That series was very successful, but it really relied on the collaboration with Hugo, who was the rapper. And so I didn't feel comfortable continuing that. It didn't feel like, you know, that was what was special about that collaboration was the two of us. So although initially I thought maybe we could continue it, in the end I realized I needed to figure out something else. And I experimented with a couple of ideas. I did a few different things.
Why did that fall apart? Was it just hard work and just a lot of work?
Yeah, definitely. It was. I think we got ourselves into a situation where it became not pleasant to do it anymore. You know, I feel like, you know, I think all projects all collaborations have that window, you know, in which they you have this amazing productivity and, you know, things work and then they don't. And I think for Hugo especially, he wanted to do a lot of other stuff. Yeah, he's an incredibly talented guy. And, I mean, you should see him do live shows and freestyles. It's kind of really impressive. And he wanted to do a lot more of that. And he didn't have enough time because we got ourselves into this situation, which was we had a contract with RT, Russia Today, to produce content. So we were on a schedule, and the Russians were quite, you know, strict about, you know,
making sure. What happens if you miss a deadline with the Russians?
Yeah, there was a guy who was always CC'd in our emails called Vladimir, and we had a joke that was Putin, that he was CC'd in all the emails.
I forgot you had a partnership with Russia Today.
Yeah, that was another fun thing that happened.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole, I'm happy to talk about it, but that's a whole other thing. After we finished that show, I you know, I was kind of like, well, what am I going to do now? And had a few different ideas that I tried out. And the third video that I made was a video, an honest government ad. Christopher Pine had, or at least the, I can't remember who the minister was, but they'd pressured UNESCO to remove Australia from their sort of the areas that had been that are under threat from climate change, including the Barrier Reef. And we got UNESCO to just sort of erase it. And it was kind of like a typical like band-aid solution. Let's not fix the reef so that it's not endangered. Let's just pressure UNESCO to not put them on the endangered list of places, you know. And it had an amazing response. Like people really loved it. And there was no actor involved. It was just Lucy. I think we did it in a day. You know, I wrote it. We had a couple of beers. We wrote it. We recorded it. I just pasted a few images together, and the format really resonated with people. And initially, I thought this would be one of the things that we'll do here at the Juice Media. But people loved it so much, and I realized pretty quickly that we could do so much. I mean, just the Australian government alone provides us so much more material than we can deal with. But then there's other shit governments, you know. I mean, yeah. We're constantly getting emails from people in Brazil, in Canada. Specifically Alberta, in the UK, in, you know, so many places, India, that people are saying, like, please, can you make something about, you know, the Ukraine or Hungary? I mean, the list goes on. And I realized, and then we could do ones about past issues. I mean, I would need 3 or 4 lifetimes to do all the videos that I would like. You should see my list of, you know,
please, to-do if list. You're listening, give Giordano some more money, go to Juice Media's Patreon.
It's not even money, it's time. You know, it's that's the thing. It's that's the limit is more to time. So it's more like, actually more than money. It's like if you're a talented writer and researcher, you know, and you want to help write stuff, get in touch. That would help more.
If you're a brain ready to be exploited for Patreon money. Well, I don't think that's you know, out of the question. I'm a very collaborative person, and we've got a Discord server now, and comedians who want to be part of Irrational Fear chime in with jokes and help write the show and give up ideas, and we've got a very thriving conversation about shitfuckery that's happening around Australia. That's a real thrill, you know, to see all these folks in a virtual writer's room participate. And I don't think there's anything wrong with getting extra brains in, because this stuff is hard to do, you know. It's very difficult to do and can be very draining.
Mm. Yeah. Totally, yeah.
Yeah. When you started, you were a young man.
That's right. It's true, yeah.
Let's talk about RT for a second. We've both worked for state broadcasters. I've worked for Al Jazeera in the past, the broadcaster of Qatar, and you've worked for RT.
Worked for brutal regimes.
We've worked for
propaganda
brutal regimes.
Broadcasters,
yeah. Soft power, they like to call it. Yes. Soft power. Soft power of hard power.
Yeah.
How did you find that experience, and what did you do? You have any feelings about it now?
Yeah, look, I mean, it was a fascinating experience. It was a really good learning experience. It really forced us to really be organized, and even though I kind of sort of talked us down a little bit earlier, I think we did a pretty good job actually of rising to the challenge. It was a pretty complicated show that we did, Rap News. I don't know if any of your listeners remember it.
Absolutely incredible early days of Juice Media. Incredible stories, Wrapped. It's in the name, you know, the news Wrapped.
Yeah.
But incredible guest performances too, from people like Julian Assange and other folks.
Yeah, we had Noam Chomsky and a few others, yeah. It was a really interesting experience, and, you know, we didn't go into it naively thinking, oh, this is just wonderful. We were quite aware of the implications, and in fact, we didn't agree to sign up with RT straight away. They approached us very early on. I think it was like 2010, after we did the very first videos about WikiLeaks in 2010, which really helped a lot of people to understand what was happening, what WikiLeaks was, who Julian Assange was in the very early days in 2010. And so they approached us then, and they were like, oh, would you like to do, we'll get you to do a show. We'll give you a show on RT. And we were like, yeah, nah, thanks. Like, you know, we really wanted to build our own independent name and brand and voice. And so we didn't want to be absorbed by this giant which would become an RT show. Yeah. And then they would then maybe spit us out, and then it would be like, well, that's gone. You know, we wanted to be a separate thing. So we said, yeah, maybe. And then 2011, they were like, a new producer. would you know, from RT would be like, oh, you're still keen? Are you interested in that? Well, maybe. And then eventually in 2013, we said yes. And we negotiated for about a year. It was the most hardcore fucking negotiation that I had with these Russians about the terms of the agreement. And we were like really, really strict that it had to work for us, because they were like, oh, we want a video every, they wanted like a, you know, a video every 2 videos a month. And we're like, you're insane and we can't do that. And then we're like, okay, video every year. And we're like, we can do 10 videos because we need time off as well. And then we need full editorial independence. Like, we don't want anyone telling us what we can and can't say. The only thing that we'll censor is the swear words. And, you know, we even negotiated that we would be able to upload to our YouTube channel first, you know, so
wow,
that, and then to
huge,
them afterwards.
That's a huge deal.
Yeah. So like, you know, we really kind of like, and we were quite ready to walk away from it. Like, if they said they didn't want that, they weren't okay with it, we were like, well, that's sorry, we're going to leave it then. But they agreed to all these terms. And I have to say, to their credit, like, they really respected all of those terms, especially their editorial independence. I think everyone thinks that when you work for RT or possibly Al Jazeera, that you're like, you know, there's some person telling you what you can and can't say or removing words. Actually, the funny thing is I've had that happen with Western NGOs that I've worked with, who've really kind of tried to bully us into what we could and couldn't say. And I've said to them, you know, I'm not going to name them, but I actually said to one of them, I was like, you know, this is fascinating. I've worked with RT, you know, Russia's state television, and over 2 years, and we never had anyone telling us what you're telling me now over the phone. It's like,
I would argue I've had more editorial, I had more editorial freedom at Al Jazeera than I ever had at the ABC.
It speaks, yeah, it says something. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Look, maybe it doesn't even say anything bad about the ABC, but it definitely blows away a lot of the stereotypes that we have about some of these, you know, they've got, as you call it, the soft power. Let's not kid ourselves. There's a reason that RT was interested in what we're doing, is because we're putting out a lot of videos that were critical of US imperialism, of US foreign policy, and also domestic policy. That was the focus of Rap News. So it definitely served the purpose. But it also helped us, because what it did is it allowed us to quit our jobs. I mean, I was working part-time at uni, and that contract was coming to an end, and Hugo was teaching. He was an English teacher. And it allowed us to fulfill our dream, which was to be full-time creators. You know, it gave us that freedom, you know.
Would you ever do a collab, now the US government's changed, would you ever do a collab with the US government? Say on the Green New Deal or something like that.
Oh, you mean with the Biden government? No, definitely not. Yeah, that would be the surest way to destroy all the goodwill and independence and the value of the brand that we've created. Yeah, totally. No, I mean, like, you know, sometimes if we're going to support what governments are saying, we did a video about the coronavirus last year, just as the pandemic was kicking off. It was mid-March, and there was so much confusion. I'm sure you remember. It was like, is it, you know, what do we do? Do we, you know, do we wear masks? Don't we wear masks? You know, do we take it seriously? Don't we? What do we wait? You know, and we put out this video, which basically, you know, helped really governments to put out this. In fact, we put it out before the government was able to come up with its own coherent communication strategy. So sometimes we help governments, you know, in that regard. But I'm not.
Many would argue that they're still trying to come up with a coherent communication strategy.
Absolutely, yeah, totally. But sorry, I was just going to say with RT, you know, one of the little stories that I think maybe some people appreciate it, but so many people, it just kind of went under the radar. When we signed up with RT, we kind of really realized we'd never spoken about Russia. We'd never really, you know, it had been mostly about Australian and US politics. And we were like, okay, now that we're working with RT, we have to talk about Russian politics. So we were very conscious that by entering into this agreement, we also had to turn the critical eye and satirical eye towards them. So we created a Russian character. At the time, there was a lot of persecution of LGBT people in Russia, probably still is, but at the time it was a real issue, and there was
a prominent issue.
Prominent issue in the media, and persecution also of Greenpeace activists up in the Arctic. So those are some of the issues. And then about 2 months after we signed this fucking agreement, Putin invaded Crimea, and we were like, oh fuck you, man. Like, seriously, like, now we can't not talk about this, you know? And I think a lot of people who think that by signing up with RT, the Juice Media was like compromising itself, kind of have to look at that episode that we put out, because it was, you know, we impersonated Putin and we created this character, Russian character, who was an RT reporter, and we totally ripped into Putin and RT and satirized you know, Russia's peaceful, so-called, in inverted commas, invasion of Crimea. So yeah, that was some of the stuff that we did to mitigate our concerns around working with this propaganda arm of Russian government, was to actually, okay, we'll do this, well, now we're going to make satire and make fun of you as well. So I feel like it was that was our attempt to balance the two things.
And obviously you felt safe being here in Melbourne, yeah, exactly. Far away from the heavies of Russian from the Gulag, security. Yeah.
Absolutely. It would have been a different story. And respect to people who, you know, who do the job that we do in countries where, you know, we've seen these comments. It's like, fuck, man, if someone made that video here in Malaysia or in India, you'd be gone, you know, and that's always worth remembering that the freedom that we have in this country to do this is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I made a Where the Bloody Hell Are You video on Manus Island and I got deported.
Deported from Manus Island.
From Manus Island.
Yeah, right. Back to Australia. Yeah. Yeah. Good. It's good that it wasn't the other way around.
It wasn't the other way around, which is possible in theory, I guess. I mean, there are Australians locked up on Christmas yep. Island as we speak.
And Dutton can strip your citizenship if you have a dual one.
Yeah. Oh, are you excited about, you know, Dutton sending out cease and desist letters and threatening people with defamation?
Oh, well, I'm just disappointed that I haven't received one. Have you?
What's the best postal address for Dutton's people to send you one? No, I haven't sent one either. No, I haven't been sent one either.
Who has he sent them to?
Just people on Twitter who said remotely defamatory things about Peter Dutton.
On Twitter?
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
Wow. Yeah, I know. Yeah. What a thin skin. I remember the first time I made a kind of government ad, a government ad parody, would have been 2006. It was a Where the Bloody Hell Are You parody.
Right.
And I got a cease and desist from Gilbert and Tobin, who were Tourism Australia's lawyers, saying that
wow.
The music that I'd used was exactly the same, but it wasn't because I got my music commissioned to be a sound alike. And so they asked me to pull it down.
What idiots.
They asked me to pull it down off my website. And I said, the only similarity between my music and your music is the word nah, because it was nah, 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 nah. So I said, I've done a do version, a whistle version, and a Crazy Frog remix version, and I've republished those. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's...
And what happened in the end?
Oh, I never heard from them again. But it was,
oh, so you didn't cease and desist?
No, I kept publishing.
Right, good.
And respect. Spread it far and wide.
Respect.
But that was the first time that I went, oh, there's real power in using the tools of propaganda
yeah.
against the propagandists.
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
And they're scared. Absolutely, you know, they're yeah. scared enough to send you a letter.
Yeah.
As a 25-year-old kid, that was super exciting to me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's also a reminder that we have really shit copyright laws here in Australia. We don't have a fair use. I mean, in theory, there's a fair use exclusion in the Copyright Act, but it's never been tested in court. So I found out about this when we got letters from, it wasn't from the government for this, it was from the writers of the John Farnham song, The Voice,
right,
which we got Julian Assange to parody. So we changed the lyrics and we got, you know, we didn't change the music, but we got it, we re-recorded it, so it wasn't the actual song.
Track.
And we got a session musician to sing. And I just thought, this is a parody. It's obviously modifying it. It's obviously it fills the definition yeah, of parody.
It should work under satire and parody for yeah, fair dealing.
You yeah. would think so, but because of the shitty untested fair use clauses here, the publishers were able to sort of put pressure on us and say, well, you know, we don't agree. We don't agree that that's satire. And then the early response you can have is like, we'll see you in court. And you know, I was like ready to do it. And I was like, is anyone going to take this on? Because this would be a great, this would set a great precedent, you know, for testing the fair use clause in the Copyright Act.
Absolutely. And a very public one too. Yep. Now, if that happened again today, would you go to court?
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, somebody's got to fucking do it. And, you know, as long as you've got good backing and you know, because you can't afford it yourself. You've got to have,
sure.
it's got to be a.
Yeah, surely. I feel like this is a Kickstarter yeah. campaign ready to go, a yeah. GoFundMe campaign yeah. ready to go to test this thing court.
It's no,
gotta,
totally.
It's
yeah.
got to exist.
And it was high profile because it had Julian Assange was impersonating John Farnham. We even got John Farnham. He even like said, yeah, I'm cool with it. It was the publishers, you know, the gatekeepers that kind of. Didn't quite see the humor of it, kind of thing.
So know? I remember that clip. Did you end up cease and desisting that one? Did you end up taking that one down?
No, we didn't. But we had to pay them. We had to give them all the revenue from the video. So we kind of got hijacked by them, you know. And I thought, well, this is sucks, but it meant that the video stayed up, you know.
Would you say that's a low price to pay? Or
I think it's a shit price. Like we shouldn't have to pay anything for it, but we didn't have anyone. you know, I reached out to people and no one was really keen to take it on. So I was like, well, what are we going to do? You know,
yeah.
I'm not going to spend the next 5 years of my life trying to scrapple up pennies to fight a copyright thing.
Giordano, thank you so much for the work you do. Thank you so much for the smarts and the funnies over a decade worth of work. It's a great privilege to have you on the Greatest Moral Podcast of our generation, and to do it inside the inner sanctum of where the magic happens.
Inside the bunker and the volcano where we live.
Undisclosed location.
In Melbourne.
Yeah.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for taking the time. It's like I said, we're part of like a bit of a network, a bit of a family. Yeah, exactly. So
a comedy cabal.
Yeah, yeah. So it was really nice and I appreciate it. And I can't believe that it's been 10 years. It's, I always started doing this as something fun and something that might be, you know, something to get a bit of a release, and always been a bit of a class clown. So I thought it was like, you know, something to sort of keep that alive. And it's a privilege to be able to do it, you know, and thanks to you also for the work that you do with Irrational Fear. You know, I think we're all helping in some small way to unfuck things. So thank you.
That's a beautiful. That's now my poster quote, helping to unfuck things. Juice Media. Thanks, G.
Well, that was Giordano. What did you think of Giordano?
Love it. I love when someone's like awesome on video and then like also in podcast form as well. I feel like I understand how these Juice Media videos get made.
Yeah, Giordano, I had the privilege of, you know, we recorded that inside Giordano's house in his studio where he records every single one of those fake government.
Where the magic happens.
Yeah, yeah. And he's got this green screen, he rolls out for it, and kids have got like crayon drawings all over the walls. It's just amazing. So it's a very homemade, scrappy operation, but he has so much reach.
Love it.
Next up is Rod Quantock. He's an absolute legend, but like we said, it's a little depressing, so I understand if you switch off now. Rod, first of all, thanks very much for joining us for the Greatest Moral Podcast of our generation.
Very kind of you to invite me.
Not just anyone gets to come on. This is a podcast where we talk to climate leaders from around the world just for, you know, half an hour or so about, you know, leading people in climate. And I can't think of anyone better to talk to than right now during comedy festival season than yourself. I remember doing a panel with you about satire and politics at the Parramatta Riverside Theatre sometime, I don't know, probably 2008, 2009, which the great John Pinder organised. And I remember you saying one line that really stuck with me ever since, and it was that you have changed the entire way you do comedy in that it's all about climate change because there's nothing else to do jokes about. And I thought that would be the great place to start, because ever since you said that line, I've been feeling exceedingly guilty about the kind of jokes I'm telling and have progressively made them mostly about climate change.
You're a good man, Dan. You're a good man.
Talk me through that journey.
In 2007, I got what used to be called a Keating, Australia Council Fellowship, which I had a choice of doing over 1 year or 2 years part-time, and I chose the 2 years. And the idea of that program was that in 2008, I was going to be 60 years old. So I thought what I wanted to do was a project that looked at the world from the day I was born until 2008. It wasn't autobiographical in any way. It was just to look at how the world had evolved over that time. And I'm a very literal person, so I did it chronologically. And I got to 1973, I think it was, the great oil shock. And I realised then that we were extraordinarily vulnerable to problems with oil, particularly running out of it. But I also started to see references to climate change. So I got really interested in that. And I have an extraordinary admiration for science. My hobbies generally are reading about science or mathematics, neither of which I can do, but I can read about them. And as I read about it, and I just read about it, and I just read about it, I just saw that it was an extraordinarily overwhelming problem, an existential threat, which is now, you know, within a year or so, I worked out that we're heading for the sixth major extinction. And in 2008, I really thought, well, what you got to do is tell people that the climate's changing and it's a really big problem. So
2008, that seems not so long ago. That seems like a time before this kind of reached zeitgeist. You were very much ahead of your time, and I think for talking about this, you know, within the general population. Is that your impression of that?
Look, and it remains what it was then. It's just another item in the news. Okay, it gets overwhelmed by Prince Harry going back to England, and it gets overwhelmed by Buddy Franklin's groin, and you know, yes, and floods here, but, and very few commercial interests in their news coverage mention climate change as a factor in weather disasters.
98% of Australia's fauna might have gone extinct, but there was a footballer that pissed in a dog's mouth.
That's
so we
exactly
should probably
right.
focus on that.
Look, I've stopped blaming anybody. I mean, I blame the people who know and deliberately obfuscate. But the other side of it is that it's not just climate change. It's a systemic problem. It's the way we live and it's the way we consume. And it's the way that the propaganda of capitalism keeps lulling us into thinking that infinite growth is possible on a finite planet. And so there's no, I've given up. We're going to have a mass extinction. It's going to become unlivable in parts of Australia in the very near future because nobody's doing anything. Even the countries like Germany or I don't know, think of another one that might be doing something, are not doing enough. And because really what you have to do as a policymaker in dealing with climate change is you've got to say to people, you've got to have less. And politics is really based on telling people they can have more. And the first person that says you've got to give up your V8 Holden for a car that just goes and doesn't go brum, 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 those people are not happy with the idea of transitioning to a low carbon economy. And we now probably have to reduce our economic output by more than 10% a year to reach any sort of feasible goal by 2030. And that's just not going to happen. So I'll look it away. I still do stuff about climate change. Nobody wants to hear it, so I don't get many bookings.
Well, that was my question. Like, how did you feel when you made this kind of commitment to do this back in, you know, 08? How did you feel about the rest of your comedy career?
Well, look, I've always done stuff that's been, as Andrew Bolt labels me, I've always been a far-left comedian. Most people aren't interested in politics. People don't know enough about politics for you to make really sophisticated jokes about it either. I remember I was doing a show many years ago about, just about politics in general. But a woman came up to me after the show and she said, I love your shows because it means I don't have to read the newspapers for a year. And that's what I do. I mean, it's probably what you do. You read things that the general public don't read. You follow stories and issues in a way that people who go to work 9 to 5 and then find the cheapest cocktails in central Sydney don't have time to do. So that's what I did. And because of, you know, personal issues around my family's health, I don't get to get out much anyway. So I just tracked myself down this horrible rabbit hole, which I really wish I'd never gone down. But at the beginning, back in 2007, 2008, when I started introducing climate change and the limits to growth into what I was doing, I really did think it was just a matter of telling people. And I chose... I'm not a writer. I mean, I never write a show, so it's difficult for me to pen a 10,000-word essay about climate change, although I've tried.
I don't know about that, Rod. I've been to plenty of your shows and I can see the amount of writing you do during the shows.
That's exactly right. Look, my hard drive, I've got a terabyte of stuff on climate change, everything from a wonderful program that David Attenborough did in 2006 on climate change, telling us exactly what I've been telling you now, never shown in Australia, and nobody paid any attention in the countries where it was shown. And then I saw all these scientists who were writing popular articles in magazines and newspapers, and I thought, well, that territory's pretty much covered and it doesn't seem to make any difference. And I, one of the things I thought at the time is you can't change people's minds in 5 minutes. And you can't even change their minds in an hour.
No.
You really need to get them to commit to understanding what you're talking about, and very few people do that. I know, I've made a few climate change friends over the years who share my despair, but we've stopped talking about it to each other. So it's got to that level. I mean, I still need to make a living, and if I'm going to go and talk to people, I'll talk about climate change and peak oil and, you know, the fact that 96% of all animals on the planet now today are either humans or the animals they eat. It's just we have so overshot the limits of the planet, and there's just no way back. So, look, it's really distressing. I had a time there about 6 or 7 years ago when I thought, well, look, this is the problem. All the people I talk to, and, you know, you don't buy tickets to a show that you don't want to know about. So the people who come are, you know, down the path. But what I saw was a lot of great, good, wonderful people who were basically giving all their spare time and a lot of their personal wealth to trying to transition to a carbon neutral economy. And I knew it wasn't going to happen, and I knew they were wasting their time. So I tried to redirect their energies, in, if you like, not into changing the global economy, not into changing the Australian economy, not even changing the Victorian economy, but to find ways to live sustainably within small groups, which is that's the future. That's what's going to happen. And if you can't live sustainably within a small group, if you remain dependent on the system that's crumbling, you're going to die. It's just you're going to die. I mean, next pandemic, I had a job at Melbourne University for 2 years back in 16 and 17, I think, as a research fellow. And I did a lot of fellowing and I did a lot of researching. And I sort of got to the point where I didn't want to know anymore. I knew too much. But I did produce, it's not finished, it'll never get finished because I'm not a writer, but I did produce a long form document which included predictions for the period 2018 to 2030. And one of the things I predicted in that back in 2017 was a global pandemic, viral pandemic in 2023.
No way.
Well, if you do the reading, you don't have to be I'm not a genius. I'm just somebody who reads a lot and has particularly my admiration for the scientific method is overwhelming. But it's like everything that humans do, it has a dark side.
With that prediction, what were the steps that led you to that prediction? What were the things that you concluded that, you know, 2023 roughly would be when a global pandemic would happen?
Well, this was, I can't remember when SARS was, but there had been a number of diseases which had passed rapidly, mainly because of aeroplane travel, that had passed rapidly into a global environment. And so I read about that as one of the problems we faced, and the literature I read just said that this is going to happen. It's going to happen very quickly, and there will come a strain which is COVID, and there'll be worse than COVID to come because viruses are very clever. So it just I apologise for being 3 years out. But for anybody who did the work that I did, that was the logical conclusion of where we were heading in terms of these things. And then other things like, you know, the bushfires of last year, I sort of left that a bit open in terms of when it would happen, but I knew that was going to happen within a few years as well. Because that's, you know, the great thing about science is that you stand on the shoulders of giants, and each little increment that you make to their understanding, can then be, you can project in ways that you can't project with the financial market, for example. I mean, you can take a gamble on saying that Amazon's a stock to buy. But in terms of climate change, it's a very simple equation. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere causes the temperature to rise, and the more you put in, the higher the temperature will go, which changes the whole weather patterns of the globe. And it also much more slowly changes the patterns of oceans. So you might remember the group called 350.org. Did you ever?
Of course, yeah, 350.org, started by Bill McKinnon.
That's right. And it was 350 was the maximum amount of CO2 in the atmosphere before we hit a tipping point.
Yeah, 350 parts per million.
Yeah. Right? Now, it turns out that that was only a sort of nice round number to call something, you know, if you wanted to run an organisation. I mean, you know, 312.5.org just doesn't cut it. So it was an approximation, and they were wrong to think 350 parts per million wasn't a problem, but they had to start somewhere. And now I didn't look, I've stopped looking, but we're probably close to 420 parts per million at the moment of a historic, or certainly in terms of human evolution, a historic baseline of around 280 parts per million. So we're so far over the scale. And you can see, you know, with the floods that you in Sydney and people in Queensland have experienced, and then the cyclone on the other side, and now there are bushfire alerts in South Australia today. It's just gone crazy. The weather's just gone crazy. And if you live near the coast, don't. I mean, that's all I can say. But, you know, those things of rising sea level, which come with thermal expansion of the oceans and melting of ice caps and so on, those now are pushing salt water up into rivers that never had salt in them before. And they're pushing salt into arable land that didn't have salt on it before. And, you know, it's no mistake, you know, no accident that the Romans, when they conquered somebody, salted the land. To make sure that no other people could use that land to build an opposition to the Roman Empire. So it's everything. It's just everything. So, you know, I have days when I think I shouldn't talk to people about this, because what's the point of people knowing? Is it better to just eat, drink and be merry? But it's something that I think certainly I remember an article by Andrew Bolt. I don't read him anymore because he gives me an ulcer. But he was talking about Tim Flannery talking about sea level rise of a metre by 2100. And the line he had in it was, 2100, long after we'll be dead. And it was that lack of any empathy for generations yet to come. And you saw it, and again, I did read a bit of Bolt during the pandemic, and you would have seen it in America, people saying, well, the only people who die are old people. And Andrew Bolt actually had a statistic that said the average length of stay of an elderly person in a care home is 9 months. So really, what's 9 months left less on your life when you're 80 or 90.
Terrible.
So let's keep the economy going, and these people will have to pay the price for the younger people. You know, if you stand in the way of a man and his profits, he'll crush you. And that's what's happened with the climate debate.
This is a really strange kind of attitude to have. It's only when you realise that conservatives – the only thing they're conserving is their money. Yes. Like that's the only thing.
It's a very strange word to use for them. But see, these are the people who are buying bunkers and fortresses in New Zealand. I mean, these are people who think they can buy their way out of any problem.
This kind of, does this speak to your idea of living within small groups as opposed to on your own or in the big systems?
Well, you can't, oh, look, I mean, there are people who literally do live on their own. And I'm sure there's, you know, tens of thousands of them around the world who've chosen that path. And there've been, I did look at the sort of utopian sort of 60, 70 ideas of communes, but they never last because people are people. And that's the overarching problem. If I die or when I die, I shouldn't say if, when I die, I want to have put in the Oxford Dictionary of quotes, Rod Quantock said, the problem with people is they're only human. And that's the problem with people. You know, we're malleable. We've got wiring that crackles and breaks, and you know, we just are. There's no other species on the planet that has such a diversity of mood, temperament, and lust and greed and the seven deadly sins. You just never see a greedy lion. You see a lion that's had enough to eat and they go to sleep. So we are the problem. And it's been a battle, you know, it's a philosophical battle that goes back to the very beginnings of humans, the battle to understand where we sit in all of this and what our obligations are to each other and to the surrounds. And the one book I always recommend to people is a book by a guy named Daniel Quinn, who wrote a book called Ishmael. And Ishmael, I won't bother you too much with it, but Ishmael ends up being a sort of Socratic dialogue between a captive gorilla and a writer who's sort of wondering why the world's fucked and should he try and fix it or what should he do. And it's a dialogue about humans' place in nature. And Quinn draws a line between two ways of living with the advent of agriculture. Basically, prior to that, people did live in small groups. They didn't fight much because everybody knew everybody else, and the little group had a way of dealing with people that, like Aboriginal people, laugh at in their sort of traditional way of living. They'd laugh at people who did things they disagreed with. They'd humiliate them with laughter. People had ways of dealing with it. But what agriculture did, first of all, it formalised the ownership of land, and prior to that nobody owned anything. They shared it with everything else. And then it developed systems to protect their ownership. Because an acre of land given over to crops can support a lot more people than 10 square miles of the equivalent amount of crops, population started to aggregate and accumulate and grow. And then, of course, you needed hierarchies because there were people in that community that you never saw but could come around and kill you tomorrow. so there were systems of law and systems of politics and hierarchy and of course, religion came into it. So there just was that time when we went from being part of nature to trying to control nature, and that's what we've done ever since. You know, I lived next door to people when I was growing up who used to vacuum their lawn. They'd go out, and rather than rake the leaves, they'd actually vacuum them up. And
with a blower.
Yeah, and I mean, air conditioning is another way of how we've tried to control nature. I mean, everything we do is to keep nature at bay. It's a place that frightens and terrifies us, but it's also a place to exploit. And we've done that, to the ultimate peril of the planet. It's really sad. And look, I at different times I try to float above it all and try to be that wise fool that looks down on you all and goes, ho, 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 look at you silly little ants. but you can't. You're in it. You're part of it. And so, as I said, I don't put much more time into studying these things because I'm only learning what I already know, and I'm not being arrogant with this, but I think the one thing I bring to what I do always is some sort of intellectual honesty, I suppose. And I've always tried. There came a time in my comedy career, and not really since the 60s have I done comedy that's autobiographical. I'm not interested in my relationships as a public event. I'm not interested in my family as a public event. I'm not interested in lots of things as a public event. But I'm interested in public events as something to talk about. And I finally got to the point where I realised that comedy is a tool. And that it is a privilege to be able to get up in front of now six people, but what used to be 500 or 600 people, and talk to them using comedy as a sort of sugar coating about things that are really important.
When you were doing climate comedy, what made you feel the best? Like when you were doing the comedy, what kind of gave you a sense of either progress or change or achievement? Can you remember a moment?
No, not a moment. As I said, I talked to the converted, so in one way, you know, it was a safe space for me to do this stuff. But right. I used to do corporate stuff before they woke up to me. And I did, of all things, I did a conference for plumbing suppliers.
Right.
So I talked to them about water and climate change. I talked to them about urban fabric and climate change. I talked to them about plastics and climate change. I talked to them about, and look, I think I'm a reasonably good comedian and I did make them laugh, but I did make them think, and a few of them did come up to me afterwards and talk to me about it.
And oh, great.
So, you know, I mean, look, it would have floated out of their minds by now, I'd imagine. But in that moment, you did get the feeling that you'd done something positive and good.
Did you ever think when you started doing climate comedy that you could make a difference?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. My first thought with it all is that, as I said, you can't change people's minds in 5 minutes. You can't change people's minds if they're told that the extraordinary flooding that you've had up there in the last few weeks is contributed to by a large degree. And I would think within a week or two, scientists will tell us exactly what proportion of that rain was generated by climate change. It doesn't add up for people even if it hits their own door. I mean, I've seen people in America standing in the rubble of, you know, Katrina or Hurricane Harvey or those things saying, I don't believe in climate change. And they're the same sort of people who say, I don't believe in the coronavirus. It's just too difficult. So, and so I thought the only way to do it is in some sort of long form way. And making it personal, you know, there's nothing like a live performance. Television never, particularly in terms of comedy, never carries that extraordinary feeling that an audience and you as a performer get from being in the same room. But, yeah, all I do now, unfortunately, is I scare people. I used to get bookings in high schools to talk about it. And I did do a primary school, which was great fun, but I did a high school, it'd be 10 or 12 years ago now, and a mother contacted me afterwards and she said to me, how dare you tell my son we're all going to die? And I thought at one level, well, somebody's got to tell him, but at the other level, what right have I got? And I've tried to find people. Well,
Is it people like this that discourage you from doing it, or is it something else?
No, what discourages me is that even if the whole world turned around today, it's over. It doesn't matter how much you cut carbon emissions with 420 parts per million today, and it goes up, you know, it seems insignificant, but it goes up 2 or 3 parts per million every year, and it just rockets along, you know, but there's a lag between a molecule of carbon dioxide entering the atmosphere and its capacity to fully express the energy it's captured. So, and that's quite a lag. And getting carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere is short of some technological miracle, which I can assure you will never appear. It's going to take thousands of years to get the climate back to what it was, and then many, many thousands of years for life to evolve in that new stable climate. And by then, there's probably going to be another ice age. So, you know, we had one shot at what's called the Holocene, the Goldilocks era of life on this planet. It's the only geological period in 4.5 billion years that has had a stable climate at this global average temperature of 13.7 degrees Celsius in the history of the planet. And it just turns out that it's ideal for humans. We are the size we are the shape we are, our metabolism works the way it does because of this climate that we have. And the way we eat, the way we live, the, you know, everything is based on that underlying stable temperature. And, you know, each degree it goes up, you know, you said something earlier about how many species have gone extinct. It's, you know, it's 100 a day or whatever. People don't know because we still don't know everything that there is in nature. And a lot of it we'll never know because it's already gone and we didn't notice it was there in the first place. So I've had this sort of moral ethical dilemma as to what right do I actually have to tell people that this is going to happen and there's nothing you can do about it. And I've tried really, really hard to find what you can do about it. And I came down to small groups of people living away from other groups of people, particularly people with guns, and existing sustainably.
13 years ago, Rod, you inspired me to do more comedy about climate change.
Sorry,
and,
Dan.
Now I'm inspired to go join a commune. So thank you.
No, that's a pleasure. But look, clearly there are things that need to keep talking about. But
do you think your pessimism stands from, you know, what you've learned plus where you are in your life?
No.
Because I feel like without sounding disrespectful, I've got a bit more of a longer runway ahead of me than you do. So I have to remain hopeful.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I'm not pessimistic in the sense that you mean it. And I'm not being in any way superior to anybody else when I say this. I'm just being realistic. And my one regret, because I have an incredible curiosity, my one regret is I won't be around to see what happens. I'm at one level I don't want to be, but at the other level, and I don't know whether it's an I told you so attitude, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, what we're looking at is in geological terms, we're looking at something that's never happened before, that one species has managed to change the entire nature of the planet in a very short space of time. I mean, literally, 1750, the beginning of the industrial age and the burning of coal. From that time on, we have managed to destroy most of what's valuable. The person I feel sorry for is David Attenborough because, you know, how could you do a show about nature when there's no nature left? And you can see in him something that what I have is that hope. And I hate the word hope because hoping for something stupid. But anyway, that hope that, you know, something you say may trigger a switch that makes changes. But, yeah, you know, so I've put my life and soul into this for the last more than 15 years, I suppose, now. I'm not disappointed because I didn't have a lot of faith in humanity to begin with. and that's, I suppose, the problem. And that came out of part of that research I did for the Australia Council Fellowship. I was born in 1948. 1948 was the year that Israel became a nation at the expense of the Palestinians. That is still a festering wound 73 years later or 72 years later or whatever it is, 73 years later. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was declared that year, and that's made not a jot of difference. Velcro was invented in 1948, and that has revolutionised the shoe industry. But there was that period just immediately after the Second World War was in a way the most devastated but most optimistic generation. My mother lost her husband in the war and married my father after the war. That was when things like welfare came in England, nationalisation of industries, a genuine attempt to reward the ordinary people who'd suffered through that war with a share of the good life that was coming, you know, and the average manager of a business made seven times more than the average worker in that same business. Today they make, I think it's more than 70 times what an average worker earns.
Yeah.
Real wages haven't gone up for 30, 40 years or something. And yet the wealth of the wealthy has so concentrated that now I think three people now own half of the wealth of the world. And that's not what my parents invested their lives in achieving. And the 60s was that their children rebelled against consumerism, and they rebelled against, obviously, the Vietnam War. But they had ideals which have been crushed out of people now. And it's been done at an industrial scale. The use of propaganda, marketing, PR, psychology. You know, there's not a toy in the world today that isn't designed by psychologists. You know, everything is aimed at your behaviour. Everything you think and do is harvested in some way. By somebody who could then just press particular buttons in you that you will respond to. And I think last time I read, they only need 8 data points to work out your sex, your race, your income level, your age, and God knows what else. And you know, like everybody else, if you don't turn off your pop-up blocker, you suddenly start to get things that seem very interesting to you because... They're deliberately there because they're interesting to you. We recommend this. People who like this also like that. And anyway.
Yeah, there was a case of that story in the US where a local Target sent a teenage girl a whole catalogue on baby stuff and her parents found out because the Target knew that she was pregnant before she did.
Oh, yeah, okay, all right. So how do you, you know, when the traditional media is so corrupted, when politicians are corrupted, when the internet only takes you where they know you want
your
to go
lie.
As opposed to where you want to go, everybody's a prisoner now. They know too much about us and, you know, but Freud, I blame Freud. It's all Freud's fault. There you go. I've said enough.
Well, Rod, thank you so much. I really appreciate the healthy dose of realism that you've given us on the greatest moral podcast of our generation. Generally, a more positive forum, generally a more hopeful podcast, but not this one.
No.
You've restored the balance where people's heads should be. Let me ask you, as someone who I look up to and has been a mentor of mine, and what do you think I should do with my comedy skill set or with what I have to offer? Do you think I should even bother continuing, or is there something else I should be doing?
Well, look, I guess it comes down to the fact that you need to think you're doing something. And so, I mean, without getting too mutually backslappy, I really admired you because of the path that you've taken with your comedy.
Yeah.
So, I haven't given up in the sense that I don't continue to try and talk to people and make people see what's going on. But as I said, you know, you can now, wherever you live, go to the Bureau of Meteorology or the CSIRO and they'll tell you how much rainfall you're going to get in 20 years' time. They'll tell you how much the average temperature where you live will go up in 20 years' time. It'll tell you... I used to think Tasmania was the place to go, but Tasmania's future isn't great. So I recommend it. What was the name of it? It's the southernmost town on the southern island of New Zealand. But I told too many people about it and the real estate prices have gone up, so I won't be going there. Look, there are places, but where you are isn't the place. You know, if you're in a high-rise building that depends on air conditioning and mechanical ventilation and a lift, you're not going to stay there. You can't live there. You can't expect, the pizza delivery boy to climb 18 flights of stairs to give you your pizza because you can't be bothered going out to buy the ingredients. Or everything, just everything will be different to what it is today. And, to get people to understand that is, it's an important first step. And that's why I did the thing, the Tim Tam. I really tried to make it personal. And that's what, I don't want to tell you what you should do or how to do it, but it's about making it personal. It's about taking it away from, polar bears will become extinct, the ice caps will melt. It's not personal to people. Everybody's got a DVD of David Attenborough standing next to a polar bear, and that's all they'll ever know about polar bears. And they'll always have the DVD if they ever want to see a polar bear.
I forget who said it, but I think it was a climate scientist, a science communicator or activist who said, people are going to start really caring when the footpaths start melting.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And the town you're thinking of, I think that's Invercargill.
It is Invercargill.
it's got the best name in New Zealand, Invercargill.
Yes, Invercargill. I know. It's all lovely. And it's a beautiful name, little town, and very, very remote. I keep telling people in small country towns that if they've got an Anzac memorial with a cannon in it, clean it up and point it back down the road towards Melbourne, because when people start fleeing, that's the last resort. Anyway.
And of course, we saw that during the pandemic. As the pandemic hit the cities, everyone hit the countryside.
Yep, absolutely. And toilet paper. That was it.
Make your own toilet paper.
Yeah. There's an idea. I've never worked out a way of monetizing my concerns, but that may be it.
You could do a masterclass on how to make toilet paper and sell that online.
Yeah. Please don't use poison ivy if you get stuck.
Rod, thank you so much for joining us on the Greatest Moral Podcast of our generation. Even though you may think you're being a realist, for me it was absolute joy.
Good on you. Bless you, Dan. Bye.
And that's it for the Greatest Moral Podcast of our generation. Big thank you to the Bertha Foundation, Road Mics, all of our Patreon supporters, and also please do come along to our Bega shows and our Newcastle show, and later on our Melbourne and Sydney shows. June 5 in Newcastle, June 13 in Bega, June 24 in Sydney, and July 10 and 11 in Melbourne. Of course, inshallah. I mean, who knows what Melbourne's going to be like after
today's. Look, we don't want to welcome you into our state potentially.
We are recording this on Thursday morning. Do we know how long
before the press conference
is there going to be lockdown? What's your bet?
Having come from 112 days of lockdown last year, 5 days is nothing. So that's what it takes. Let's bring 5 days versus 100.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Let us know how you feel about this podcast on iTunes with a 5-star review or 4-star, but whatever. Thanks a lot. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.